Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. In the news this morning, Governor Jay Inslee responded to Senate Republicans who last week sent his transportation secretary packing. It was late Friday when Republicans voted down Transportation Secretary Lynn Peterson's confirmation. Effectively, they fired her over concerns about her leadership of high-profile projects like 405 tolling and Seattle's tunnel project. Today, the governor said all this was a surprise to him since Republicans were singing a different tune just last year.
The experts on transportation in the Republican Senate caucus unanimously approved her confirmation without a word of concern about her performance. And now they say suddenly she's an incompetent. Poppycock. Bullfeathers. This is an election year stunt.
Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins, poppycock and bullfeathers?
Those weren't the only ones.
No? You know the governor a lot better than we do. How upset is Governor Inslee? I mean, he's got his own election coming here.
He does, and he's actually known for some of his linguistic flourishes and his word choice. But, you know, he was angry today, and I think he was as angry as we've seen him. In addition to what you just heard, he said that this was a Friday massacre. He talked about a decapitation. He said that the Senate's actions on Friday was a, quote, a gross abuse of the confirmation process. And he called out individual Republican state senators by name and then delivered withering dressings down of them by name and by individual.
Well, let's talk about what the anger toward the transportation secretary is. These Republicans are representing constituents who are mad about some major transportation projects, 405 tolls, Bertha, 520. Did the governor admit to any responsibility for those troubles?
The short answer is no. I mean, he did not acknowledge on any level that his administration or his secretary had fallen short on these points. In fact, he noted that tweaks are being made to the I-405 toll lanes as he was speaking. They're going to open, you know, them up, I think, to general purpose traffic at certain times. He said that stopping tunnel boring when that big sinkhole developed on the Seattle Tunnel Project was an example of leadership and the right thing to do on the part of Lynn Peterson as the secretary. And he praised her for implementing cost savings to highway projects. So he, I would say, doubled down on his choice for Transportation Secretary Lynn Peterson from 3 years ago and went to the mat for her and said what the Republicans did to her was, in his mind, completely out of line.
Interesting. Meanwhile, these lawmakers are in Olympia doing our business. They've got a month, basically, to get something done. Do you think the governor's words help that process, hinder that process?
Look, I think we know that there have been tensions and perhaps not a great working relationship between Senate Republicans and Governor Inslee. I think this is now what has been sort of beneath the surface has now exploded onto the front page of the newspaper, into the headlines, and the disconnect and the divisiveness is on full display. And so I think that is the key question going forward, is whether they can get back to a point where they at least have a tense but cordial working relationship, or are the gloves off, and you might as well end the session today and start the campaign season tomorrow.
This is why we have correspondent Austin Jenkins in Olympia. Austin, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is KUOW's The Record, and the news continues now. Who gets to decide which bathroom or locker room you get to use? Under Washington state law, you decide. A new rule enacted in December says people can use bathrooms and locker rooms consistent with their gender identity. Some Republican lawmakers are trying to repeal that, and many transgender rights advocates are furious. Betsy White of Spokane is one of them.
I'm the mother of five children. My youngest child is 8 years old, and she is transgender, and my 11-year-old is genderqueer.
That phrase Betsy White just used, genderqueer, that's an umbrella term to describe gender identities outside of the conventional male or female identities. As for transgender people, Betsy White told me they're already at a higher risk for discrimination and physical assault than non-trans people.
These bills are going to heighten that risk and are actually going to put transgender people at a greater risk for discrimination and for assault. In 2015, 25 transgender people were murdered in the United States simply because they were transgender. I don't want my child or either one of my children to become one of those statistics.
What makes you think transgender people would be at a greater risk?
From my experience having a 8-year-old transgender daughter, if these bills were to pass, you're telling my 8-year-old little girl that she has to go into the men's bathroom. The biggest concern from the proponents of this bill is safety in the bathrooms. Who is going to be at a greater risk? A woman who is sharing a bathroom with a transgender woman, or my 8-year-old daughter, or any other transgender woman who has to be forced to use a men's bathroom? And let's flip that. You're asking a transgender man who looks like a man to have to use the female bathroom. Who in that situation is going to be at greater risk? A woman or a transgender man who is being forced to use the woman's bathroom? That's why this is such a concern.
What has been your transgender daughter's experience with bullying or just any reaction from her fellow students when it comes to using the girls' bathroom?
When my daughter came out as transgender, it was the second day of kindergarten. And, of course, the first thing that the school did was jump on what bathroom is she going to use. And we were very adamant that she would be required to use the girls' bathroom because we did not want her to be isolated by being forced to use, say, the nurse's bathroom or the staff bathroom. If the whole classroom of 25 students is lining up to go to the bathroom and my daughter has to peel away from the rest of the classroom to go to a different location, you are highlighting that there's a difference. And it was with great reservation at the time that the school allowed her to use the girls' bathroom with the understanding that this would be closely monitored. 3 years later, there have been zero issues with my daughter using a girls' bathroom. None. As to bullying, the kids in her classroom have been very welcome and opening about the situation until their parents find out about it. Once their parents find out that their child is befriended a trans child, then that child is discouraged from continuing that friendship. But our biggest bullies in my school, in my personal school, is actually administration and staff.
Finally, Betsy, will you tell us what is something that most people don't understand about what it's like to have a transgender child?
I have to have very adult conversations with an 8-year-old child, and that is very difficult because I shouldn't have to have the conversations I have to have with my 8-year-old. I have to make sure that my 8-year-old clearly understands that she is not to go into any public accommodations by herself ever. She has to have a sibling. She has to have a buddy. She has to have somebody with her at all times because of that heightened risk of being bullied and or assaulted.
And what do you wish for as a mom?
I wish people would understand that transgender people are people. Transgender women are women. Transgender men are men. They're just like our husbands and our sons. They're just like our mothers and our daughters.
Betsy White is a mom living in Spokane. Her 8-year-old daughter is transgender. That Republican-led bill we've been talking about is still alive in the state Senate. It has not been voted on yet. An identical bill introduced in the state House did not get a public hearing. That bill is dead. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. What were Amazon and T-Mobile going for in those Super Bowl ads? And did they pull it off? We'll go there in about 15 minutes. Hope you can stay tuned to The Record. In the presidential election, New Hampshire votes tomorrow with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump leading their party's polls. While in the Seattle area, the question is, who will replace Democratic Congressman Jim McDermott? The latest candidate is former Burien Mayor Arun Jhaveri. He also worked with the federal government for more than 20 years, and Jhaveri is a physicist and a mechanical engineer who told David Hyde that Congress needs more scientists.
There are only a handful of congresspersons who have either degree in science, engineering, technology, or have experience in those fields.
Why is that level of specialization, do you think, so necessary and so missing? You mentioned very few people have science degrees, but why do you think it's such a problem?
Because we have, it should reflect the cross-section of our country. And there are scientists and engineers and people with innovations and high tech, which is booming these days. So we need to have that kind of representation in a Congress, because that we need a cross-section of people working on issues, working on legislations that benefit the country as a whole.
How would that work? I mean, of course, in terms of decision-making, scientific literacy could be hugely important, but do you also see yourself helping persuade your colleagues? Why would it be important?
Well, because we as legislators have to come up with legislation, either sponsor a new legislation, co-sponsor a new legislation, or review existing legislations in order to make it even more efficient and cost-effective. And there are, as I said, billions of dollars spent every year in the federal budget on technology-related activities, whether it's transportation, energy, environment, you name it. And so having that kind of expertise and background is important for the Congress to decide which is the best legislation. But rather than relying 100% on outside experts, it's nice to have in-house expertise so that we can work together and have some kind of conversation and come up with a legislation which is shared by all kinds of people, and we can be the initiator of the reasons why it's an important legislation.
What else would you want to get done in Congress?
I think that the climate change is an important issue for me. I have worked in that area for the last 15 years when I was the regional manager for the U.S. Department of Energy. And I think we have the tools and technologies now and financing. They call it climate finance, that there are now available. And I think that problem is of urgent nature, that the Congress should be all together behind it and start to do something by funding clean energy programs.
I'd imagine that many, if not all, of the people who are running to replace Jim McDermott for this particular congressional seat are going to agree with you about the need for solutions to climate change, probably including clean energy. Why are you the right candidate to get that done?
Because of my many years of experience, I have hands-on experience working with agencies, working with people, identifying the champions in different areas. And, you know, I strongly believe practice before you preach. And I have solar collectors on my roof of the house in Burien for the last 3 years. And I can see my meter is turning backwards in summertime. And I think it's individual responsibilities. We cannot just point fingers at the legislators like congresspeople and senators, but what you as a person have done today, and collectively we can reduce the impact of climate change.
Arun Jhaveri, former mayor of Burien, running to represent Seattle area voters in the 7th Congressional District. He talked with David Hyde there. So far, Jhaveri is the fourth Democrat to declare he's running for Jim McDermott's congressional seat. We're tweeting out links to the interviews we've done with the other candidates now, so you can listen to all of it on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Did I mention where to find us on Twitter? It's not hard. at KUOW when we tweet stuff out for you. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. 12:22 is the time. People from three Pacific Island nations have the right to live and work in the United States thanks to a unique 1986 treaty. But a separate congressional action 20 years ago means they are not eligible for Medicaid, even people who become taxpayers here. In Oregon, lawmakers are considering a bill this month that would require that state to subsidize medical care for people from these countries. KUOW's Salem correspondent Chris Lehman has the story.
The songs during this church service in Salem might sound familiar to many American Christians. But the words are all in Marshallese. That's the language spoken by people from the Marshall Islands. It's an independent nation made up of more than 1,000 small islands near the equator, about 2,000 miles southwest of Hawaii. There are 8 churches in Salem that cater to the Marshallese. The congregations are largely invisible to the surrounding community, since they typically rent space from other churches. Thousands of Marshall Islanders have made Oregon their home. They can live in the U.S. legally because of a decades-old treaty called the Compact of Free Association, or COFA. The treaty includes 2 other island countries in the Pacific, the Federated States of Micronesia and the Republic of Palau. Many in those nations were uprooted when the U.S. military tested dozens of nuclear weapons in the mid-20th century.
It was a promise that we will, you know, bring you back to your island and you'll be able to go back one day.
David Anatok is president of the Oregon Marshallese community. He says that promise has never been fulfilled. Conditions on some islands have never improved enough to allow residents to return. Anatok introduces me to Jack and Tadi Arujaman. The couple moved to Oregon about a decade ago from tiny Kili Island. Anatok served as my interpreter.
It was hard for us. There wasn't much of anything really on Kili to survive off.
Kili Island is less than half of a square mile. Both Jack and Tadi say their parents were moved there from Bikini Atoll in advance of the weapons testing and were never able to return. Jack says he scratched out a living as a farmer and home builder. He and his wife moved to Oregon to seek out a better life for their kids. But he says now he's facing a series of health problems.
One is diabetes. Being diabetic and not able to afford my medicines makes it very challenging for me. Second is my leg is it's getting weaker and I can't stand on my own.
Tadi Arujaman says she and her husband struggle to pay for his medical care. They're largely supported by their children.
When they get paid, they pay for the bills and other means of needs, like food and for the car and those things. And we don't have enough to pay for our own insurance.
It used to be that people who came to the U.S. under the COFA treaty could apply for Medicaid, the health care program for low-income Americans. But in 1996, Congress stripped that benefit as part of the overhaul of welfare programs. Now here's where the Oregon legislature potentially comes in. Lawmakers will consider a measure that would essentially restore those benefits to about 1,500 people at a cost of $1.8 million, not through Medicaid, but by helping to pay for insurance through the Affordable Care Act. The bill has 42 co-sponsors. At the Marshallese Church in Salem, an impromptu choir sings a song of thanks for a meal served after the service. Many won't ever be able to afford the airfare back to the island where they grew up. So for now, the chicken and rice are a taste of home. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. The NFL tried something new yesterday, a Super Bowl, but without the Seattle Seahawks. This has not been attempted in 3 years. The experiment was a failure in the Seattle market where viewership declined. What was of local interest yesterday were a couple of Super Bowl ads. You saw them, Todd.
I sure did, Bill.
Todd Bishop watches Super Bowls for the tech news site GeekWire. First of all, now, you know when the Drake song Hotline Bling came out.
You used to call me on my cell phone.
You could hear the cell phone companies calling Drake's agent on their cell phones, negotiating Super Bowl ads. It must have been a sweepstakes. And the winner was Bellevue-based T-Mobile. So,
that's right.
Right? So set this up, Todd. What is T-Mobile trying to accomplish with the ad that I'm about to play?
So T-Mobile has emerged as the successful underdog in the wireless carrier business, surpassing Sprint, taking on AT&T and Verizon, and they're really poking at those larger rivals in this spot.
Right. Okay, so here's the visual. It starts with Drake in his lime green Hotline Bling cube. If you haven't seen the original music video, can we tweet that out? Okay, we'll tweet it out to you because it's worth a look. You should see it anyway. It's just pop culture.
That's right.
Okay, at KUOW, we'll tweet that. So you have Drake in that cube, and then the reps from the other evil cell phone companies come up and they're making Drake change his lyrics.
You used to call me on my cell phone.
Perfect. Here are the changes.
I love changes.
When you say call me on my cell phone, just add device eligible for upgrade after 24 months.
Genius.
I'm so glad. And after going places where you don't belong, add Mexico and Canada are not included.
I've told a lot of people I'm from Canada, but...
I lied.
You know what? Also, you need to include that streaming music will incur data charges, so just slip that in there.
Yeah, sneak that in there.
Fantastic idea.
And you can't say you got exactly what you asked for because we never give them what they ask for.
Unless they ask for hidden fees.
Oh, they're evil. So, Todd Bishop, how did T-Mobile do with this ad?
I think they did well. T-Mobile has really been playing that part of poking at the industry giants, and everybody hates the complicated cell phone bills. This has been T-Mobile's game as part of its Un-Carrier initiative for about the past 2 years under CEO John Ledger, you know, at least promising to simplify things. And I think this ad really drove that home.
The second and final Super Bowl ad I'll play you was from Amazon pushing its Echo device. Why is this device so important to Amazon, Todd?
Echo contains the Alexa virtual assistant, which is essentially Amazon's response to Cortana and Siri from Apple and Microsoft. And this really is a fascinating move by Amazon to get into artificial intelligence. And I have a hunch that they're going to be using Alexa as the foundation for another push. This is my speculation in the future back into the smartphone business, trying to recover from their debacle of a Fire Phone launch about a year ago.
Okay. Yeah. Amazon is that cylinder with the lights on it. And you say, Alexa, I want this. And it responds to you.
This
is the ad, the Super Bowl ad from yesterday. Pitch man Alec Baldwin. He's at a party. I think he's hosting the party and he's a Super Bowl party. He's fighting with ex-quarterback Dan Marino.
It's my Amazon Echo. I can stream music, order things, and watch this. Alexa, turn on the lights.
Wow.
Breaded wings? You're blowing it, bro. Alexa, how many championships has Dan Marino won?
Dan Marino has won 0 championships.
Alexa, how many Oscars has Alec Baldwin won?
Alec Baldwin has won 0
Alexa, stop. Well played, Marino.
And you got Missy Elliott's there, yep. Jason Schwartzman there. So how did Amazon do?
You know, I think Amazon did well on this too. Echo has actually proven to be a surprisingly popular device. One of the reasons is that Amazon has regularly been issuing new features for it, among other things, the ability to play music through it and all sorts of things that they are showcasing in that ad. So it really got it across. And I think it was fascinating. This was Amazon's first ever national Super Bowl ad. So it was interesting that they chose to focus on this technology and this device. And I think that speaks to their future plans to take it much bigger.
Okay, briefly, I know that you talk to a cell phone and you talk to Alexa, but why is this? This seems a long way from a smartphone to me. What do you mean by your claim?
It does. I think Alexa will be the foundation, at least one of the foundational features of a future smartphone should Amazon go that direction. I think they're really basically developing the technology and the fan base now, and then they'll use that as momentum to get back into the smartphone business.
Despite the fire going out quite quickly.
Exactly.
Okay, last thing, Todd Bishop with GeekWire. Amazon is driving something around Seattle called the Treasure Truck. They sell stuff at a discount out of this truck. I use Amazon online sometimes. This seemed like a waste of fuel to me. I get what am I missing?
This is Amazon showing a bit of its personality. This treasure truck was delayed by about 7 months. They said they wanted to get the experience right. But the idea is essentially you order it on your mobile phone and it's a surprise. And then you go and pick up a heavily discounted device. In this case, it was a GoPro Hero 4, which normally sells for about $430. It was only $179, and it sold out in 45 minutes. I think this is Amazon showing its personality in a way that they haven't in the past. And I would not be surprised to see this roll out beyond Seattle to other communities across the country.
Still seems like a rolling discount bin to me.
It is.
You know,
but
it is.
It is. They liken it to an ice cream truck for adults. So if you're a kid and you don't like ice cream trucks, maybe you're an adult who doesn't like the treasure truck. I think it's something where you have to sort of set aside the actual business value and just look at it as something that's a little bit fun.
Throw in turkey in the straw and I might chase that thing. Todd Bishop from GeekWire, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
A few minutes ago on this program, Governor Inslee characterized Republican opposition to his transportation secretary as poppycock and bullfeathers. We want to thank the person who just tweeted out Mr. Burns from The Simpsons saying, "Those sandal-wearing goldfish tenders, bosh, flimshaw." That's what Twitter's for, folks. We're at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in. 12:45 now. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's Museum of History and Industry has an exhibit about the city's African-American music history. It's called The Legacy of Seattle Hip Hop. KUOW's Ross Reynolds found the exhibit is not just about the history here. It's about how Seattle hip hop fits into the larger culture.
For Dr. Dowdy Abe, author of the upcoming book Emerald Street, A History of Hip Hop in Seattle, it all began 36 years ago.
In the fall of 1979, when I was 9 years old, my father took me to a record store over there on 22nd and Union. It's not there anymore. It was called Dirt Cheap Records. And he let me pick any record I wanted for the first time. He was like, "Go pick a record." And I ran around, and I know they have the record in here somewhere, but the actual Sugar Hill Gang record, Rapper's Delight, took it home and listened to it. The vocals, I was kind of puzzled. These people weren't singing, they were talking, but you know, what they were talking about spoke immediately to me.
Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am...
My name is Jasmine Scott, and I am the co-curator of this exhibit. My father was the first DJ to play Rapper's Delight in Seattle, which introduced hip-hop.
The exhibit includes timelines that go back to the beginning.
One of the things that we want to make sure is identified and pointed out, and we kind of make reference to throughout the exhibit, is the first hip-hop group here in Seattle, which is the Emerald Street Boys. And here we have a video from the Kool Out Network that kind of highlights the Emerald Street Boys and their contribution to hip-hop in Seattle.
The Emerald Street Boys, they were the most inspirational to us in the hood, because when we was kids, seeing them or hearing about them or running into one of them on the street, it was like seeing a just straight up bona fide superstar. You know what I'm saying?
Now, I was born and raised in Seattle, Washington, where it rains all the time. Round the corner from Garfield High School, I saw a lot of freaks and a lot of fights. When the sun would come out in the summertime, that's when we jet to Seward Park with our crews and the girls switched around the dudes with slickest game, all the tightest cars, that's the way it went down.
By 1988, Seattle rapper Sir Mix-a-Lot broke nationally with his single Posse on Broadway. And by 1993, Mix won a Grammy for his ode to the female Derrier.
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny. Now when a girl walks in with an itty bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung.
1994, Diggable Planets with Seattle's Ishmael Butler were Grammy winners with Diggable Planets, Rebirth of the Slick, Cool Like That.
We beat to rap what key beat to lock, but I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that.
A burst of rap groups formed in Seattle, so many that they don't all fit into the Legacy of Seattle Hip Hop exhibit.
What kind of disagreements do you think might pop up as people see this exhibit?
One of the things we anticipate when people come through this exhibit is that they might run into the question, where am I? Where's my uncle? Where's my cousin? Why aren't we in this exhibit? We can really only put together a snapshot in the amount of time that we've had to be able to work on this exhibit. Preemptively, what we've done and what we're going to try to do to address that is we've created a Tumblr page where people from the community, when they come to the exhibit, when they leave the exhibit, they can go on this Tumblr page. They can say, hey, this is missing, and we think this should be there.
You enter the Legacy of Seattle Hip Hop exhibit through a wall of boom boxes. But the exhibit includes not just music, graffiti, art, fashion, video, dance, a full range of Seattle hip-hop culture. You'll even be able to mix your own. Aaron Walker Loud is co-curator of the exhibit.
Two of the most innovative and well-known producers, well-known around the world, Vitamin D and Jake One from Seattle, they were generous enough to give us some unreleased music. And not only just the tracks themselves, but the dissected stems, the different little small parts here and there separated and isolated. So people who come to the exhibit can actually break down and manipulate isolated parts of their compositions to see how these things are even built.
So why is it that Seattle, one of the whitest cities in the nation, has become such a wellspring of rap? Dr. Dowdy Abe.
The mainstream narrative about hip-hop is that it's this black thing that came from black culture. And that part is true. It did come out of the African-American experience. But the culture itself has always been extremely diverse. You know, certainly it started off in the Central District, but eventually those cultural shockwaves that hip-hop initially sent to young people in the CD kind of spread out, first to the South End, Beacon Hill, and then throughout the rest of the city. So, and look, hip-hop has always been a completely inclusive thing. If you listen to the beginning of Rapper's Delight, the first line, first stanza of Rapper's Delight.
Wonder Mike, and I'd like to say hello. Or to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta...
I'm Wonder Mike, I'd like to say hello to the black, to the white, purple, and yellow, shouting out all the races.
Culture commentators have long noted that Seattle's isolated location in the upper left-hand corner of the country allowed painting, rock music, and other art forms more license to develop its own voice. Dr. Dowdy Abe says hip-hop music from Seattle has also forged its own path.
If you think about someone like Sir Mix-a-Lot and the song Posse on Broadway, kind of the crucial point of the song when they're up at Dick's, you'll notice that in that song, now this is 1987, 88, Mix-a-Lot goes, they're up at Dick's, they get into a little beef with some other crew, and Mix-a-Lot intervenes with a man who's about to physically assault his girlfriend using some mace. That was pretty much against the kind of ultra machismo gangster rap that was emerging from places like California, groups like NWA and Ice-T at that time. The latest one, someone like Macklemore, whose thrift shop and Same Love go directly against two of the most longly held norms of mainstream hip hop, which are bling, which is the, you know, name brand, clothing, flashy jewelry type of thing, and homophobia.
If I was gay, I would think hip hop hates me. Have you read the YouTube comments lately? Man, that's gay, gets dropped on the daily. We become so numb to what we're saying.
And the fact that people are able to address those issues in those ways through the lens of hip-hop from a place like this speaks to the kind of uniqueness and originality that comes from here.
The uniqueness and originality is on display at the Museum of History and Industries, the Legacy of Seattle Hip-Hop exhibit. It's scheduled to run through May. I'm Ross Reynolds.
And since we recorded that piece, Macklemore is, of course, out with another song questioning white people's place in hip-hop. That song is White Privilege 2. We discussed it on The Week in Review on Friday. You can get that podcast on your favorite podcast app and listen to KUOW 94.9 Seattle. It is 12:53. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Gerald Hankerson was wrongly convicted of aggravated murder in 1987. After 22 years behind bars, Governor Chris Gregoire commuted Hankerson's life sentence, making him the first man in the history of Washington State to get life and then get freed. Today, Hankerson is an NAACP leader. At the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood, Rachel DeCruz asked Hankerson what his last day in prison was like.
oh, man, this is going to take a little longer. Man, you're going to need a couple extra minutes for this, because this was the big one. This is the one that, you know, I remember that I was sitting down at the table with my friend Barry Massey, who's the youngest man that's ever been convicted in the nation. He's finally coming home in February, by the way. Barry Massey.
That's fantastic.
And he's coming home in February. And, of course, we're sitting there, and my counselor come and tell me, she says, Gerald, you can't go to yard because it's workout time. It's like the superintendent want to see you. And I was like, come on, man. Every time this happened, that means pack my bags and I'm out of here again. So I done actually started saying my byes to people. I went to my room. I grabbed my phone book. Gave a message to say, man, I called my family, my number, just in case. I don't know what's about to happen. I know what that transition's about to be. No communication, no nothing. And they came and escorted me out to the office. He made all the guards get out of the office, comes in. He's sitting at the desk, and he got this yellow piece of paper and pink paper rolled up in his hand. And he says, Gerald, have a seat. And I've known him for years, even when he became a regular cop, an officer, moved up through the ranks at Monroe. So I was, his Pat Gleeby is his name. And I was like, I'm not sitting down, Gleeby. But I know that I'm used to this routine by now, man. Just what I do this time and where am I headed? And he's like, sit down. I was like, no, we had this debate. And I said, I'm looking at the goldenrod paper in the back of your hand. That means the signature that signs me off to intensive management unit. And he just said, Gerald, I just want to be the first person that says you're a free man. And he rolled out my agreement signed by Governor Gregoire to grant me my clemency. And I'm just stunned. I sat down in a chair. And there were some books that was on the table that I knocked down. There was this phone in the middle of the table. And this is on April 9th, 2009. And he slides it to me and he says, call whoever you want. And I was like, I had to call my lawyer, Cheryl McLeod, who 2-3 years ago became the newest Supreme Court judge in Washington State. That's Gold Shirt, that's my girl. And as soon as I dialed that number, she said, Gerald, are you sitting down? I said, let's not go through this again. I already know, attorney. And she was, her whole office, you could hear me in the background screaming. She said, now what does it mean? I said, I don't know. Let's ask him. And when I handed him the phone, they were talking. And that's the first time I heard him say, oh, no, no, no. We're not going through a process. I'm walking Gerald out of here tonight. And I say, let's go. He said, man, go pack your stuff, do all the stuff, the process. You know, people got to come take pictures and all of that. It was yard in. Everybody now coming back. He actually had to lock the prison down to walk me out of there because the whole prison had heard. Mm-hmm. And because too many, I mean, hugs and, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And he said, get out of here for the news come. And sent me on my way. But and my first call, the first call I got on my cell phone, on a cell phone that I've never seen in 20-some years,
yeah.
Last one was the size of suitcases. Now they got these little hand things. And it was Senator Debbie Rigala, retired from the Washington State Senate last couple years ago. But she's welcome home. I mean, it was a beautiful moment, beautiful yeah. moment, a beautiful moment.
Gerald Hankerson, on his release from prison in 2009 after 22 years behind bars. Today, he's president of both the NAACP's Seattle King County branch and the three-state conference overseeing Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. Gerald Hankerson told that story to Rachel DeCruz in a StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood. You can hear more local StoryCorps conversations at KUOW.org. Just click on the StoryCorps tab. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Were you listening to KUOW about an hour ago? The NPR show Here and Now reported on a study that showed the fastest talkers in America are in Oregon. Oregon. Now, the slowest talkers were from the South, as you might expect, so they played an example of a guest from Mississippi Public Radio who they asked before the interview started. How was your trip into the studio?
Today... got off kind of rotten because slept late, overslept, stayed up too late because of the Super Bowl. And
you get the idea. Slow talker from Mississippi. In contrast, here's an NPR guest from Oregon Public Broadcasting, Allison Frost, answering the same question. How was your trip into the studio?
Now, I had to drive the work truck, which means I can't really see and I can't maneuver as well in and out of traffic. I can't change lanes. And so it adds about 5 minutes to my commute. So, you know, it was okay, but it was a little slower than I'd like.
faster talker, right? Now, I'm skeptical of any single social science study. This one was an analysis of consumer phone calls placed to businesses across the country and recorded anonymously. But I was open. I wanted to know, why would Oregonians be fast talkers, fastest in the nation? Well, the Atlantic editor who reported on this study, Derek Thompson, really didn't have an explanation.
This is still a great mystery. It is very clear that some states talk significantly faster and that people in cities even might talk even faster than the fastest talking states. But we don't really know what's causing this. One tiny theory is that it might have something to do with pace of life. When pace of life is slow, that talking and walking is a little bit slower. And then when pace of life is quicker, people feel like the economic value of their time is higher and they become rushers, both in their ambulance and in their communication.
Yeah, but does anybody think New York City is slower paced than Oregon? And yet Oregon was way faster talking than New York in this study. So I don't know what to think. I have noticed the comedy show Portlandia often does have Portlanders rushing to make a point.
Did you read that thing in Pace? It was about the National.
Oh, I saw that. Did you see that thing in Dwell about all the mid-century houses?
Yeah. Did you read the New York Times?
Yes.
New York Observer?
Yes.
Washington Post?
Yes.
Wall Street Journal?
Of course I read it.
Did you read that steampunk article in Boing Boing?
I did not like the end of it.
Did you read that skywriting over the Willamette River?
Yes. Did you read the fortune cookie?
Yes.
From last night?
Yes.
Did you read it?
Yes.
Yeah, that's Portlandia. I don't know. Do Northwesterners talk fast? Washington ranked really high as well for fast talking. We were number 13 in this study. Speaking of talking, so long to non-talker Marshawn Lynch. The Seahawks star running back was known for not answering reporters' questions.
Yeah.
That was about all you would get from him. He announced his retirement yesterday. Without a syllable, just a wordless tweet from Marshawn Lynch with a peace sign and a photo of the cleats he's hanging up. Once again, Marshawn Lynch doesn't talk, and he still gets the final word. This is KUOW's The Record.